My name is Earl Homer, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to Cincinnati AA. I used to dance and drink in this room. I never thought I'd ever get a chance to welcome so many of my friends. This has been a beautiful experience to me. For all of you who have pre-registered, that is, all of you that sent in all those kind of checks that you did before, day before yesterday, I put my personal endorsement on each and every one of them. I have never been asked for that many autographs in such a short time. And it's never been such a pleasure to do it. As I filled in each of these registrations, wrote the envelopes, numbered the banquet tickets, I had plenty of time to form mental pictures of those of you that I didn't know personally. And you wouldn't believe some of the fantasies I cooked up. Especially the ones from Toledo. They utterly fascinated me. But the other areas are well represented too. We hope to have a beautiful weekend. We've got a lot of talent speaking to us. And some of our panels are absolutely out of this world. Sometimes I feel that we ought to... No, I don't want to suggest paying their expenses to be getting in trouble. But they are a wonderful group. We're honored tonight to have with us, to welcome you to Cincinnati, Mrs. Bobby Stern, who is councilwoman, city council, Cincinnati. A very accomplished and beloved politician. That's possible. She's pretty, too. I'm going to let her welcome you to Cincinnati. Bobby Stern?
Thank you, Mr. Homer. I'm happy to be here on behalf of Mayor Berry and the members of council to welcome you to our city. I realize that many of you are from our city, and a welcome to you, too. Anyhow, I was asked recently, Bobby, are you a politician or a statesman? And this was obviously, you know, one of those male chauvinists, because he did say statesman. And I said, it depends on to whom you're speaking when you ask that. I am pleased to be here because I've had an interest in Alcoholics Anonymous as a part of a hopeful kind of resolution to a problem that I became involved with probably because I'm a nurse and my interest from the health angle. For a long time in Cincinnati, I've worked with our health department with a variety of different kinds of health programs, and since I've been on city council, we have not been able to do enough, but we have been able to begin all kinds of programs or to help programs that are being started here in the treatment of alcoholics and the prevention of alcoholism. We have, as I say, none of them are sufficient to answer the need in that particular area. But it has been one of the things I'm interested in and have been persuasive about getting some funds appropriated. It's always at the end of our treatment programs that we look forward and are delighted that there is such an organization as yours to help other people. And so I'm happy to be here. I started reading your background of your organization and discovered to my surprise that the Dr. Bob Smith, who started this along with a Mr. Wilson, was a surgeon in the hospital where I trained as a nurse. And I knew him as a student nurse. I knew that he had had an alcoholism problem. I guess I knew that he was involved with Alcoholics Anonymous, but somehow I didn't know that he had been one of the founders. We were very fond of him. He was a big, sort of tough guy. And he had a brother, as I recall, named J.D. And anyway, the Smith brothers were very nice, interesting people and good doctors. But I didn't know that about him until I read your background. And I guess I would have been glad to help them in those days if I had known anything about it, but I didn't. Also, I imagine maybe another bit of nostalgia. As I parked tonight, I saw a bumper sticker on a car that said Randolph Fair, and I thought maybe since this is an Ohio convention, somebody's here from Randolph. And when I was a little kid, that's where we had to go to exhibit the things we made in school and draw posters for Randolph Fair. So I sort of feel this is the old home week. I do hope that you have a successful convention, and also that they will give you time, you from out of town, and if you've never been in Cincinnati before, to enjoy our city. Cincinnatians are partial to their city. We think it's beautiful, and we try to foster some of that beauty, though we're not always successful. But we do have a lot of beautiful parks. We have a river, hills. We have theater. We have a variety of museums and the zoo and a lot of nice places to go. So if they'll let you free for a few minutes, do try to get around our city and enjoy it. We hope you come back soon. It's a pleasure to have you in Cincinnati.
Thank you, Bobby Stern. Jewel Pickett is wanted on the telephone. If you will step to the back of the room, somebody will show you which phone it is. Tonight we're honored to have with us the delegate from the Northwest Ohio General Service area. Chuck and I had some interesting experiences in New York together last year. He visited me in the hospital. He's the first man that ever visited me in the hospital. I enjoyed that. And we enjoyed his conference in Toledo last summer. I know a lot of you were there. Chuck's going to introduce the speaker for us for this evening. So I present Chuck Scheer from Toledo. Chuck.
Thank you, Roy. Councilperson Stern. Fellow alcoholics, my name is Chuck Scheer, and I'm an alcoholic. You Al-Anons, too. God bless you. You know, this will probably be the last time I'll have to take part in any conference, in an official part or anything, and it's certainly been a grand experience of being chairman last year in Toledo. Last year, I was nervous and jerky. This year, I just maintained the jerky. I don't have to be responsible for anything this year, and I plan to really enjoy this conference. I know it'll be a great success. And tonight, standing in the back of the room, my sobriety was further strengthened when I stood in between, and I have permission from the speaker to break his anonymity. I stood in between the Pope and Jack Dempsey, and I felt very secure. The Pope was a fellow from Columbus. He came up and introduced himself to me as the Pope, and I introduced him to Jack Dempsey. And I feel very secure with that kind of protection. But without any further ado from me, I'll give you Jack D. from Pittsburgh.
Hi, my name is Jack Dempsey. I'm not the fighter, I'm the drunk. And I got enough confidence from Alcoholics Anonymous to know I'll do better here tonight than the Pittsburgh Pirates. I was the kind of guy that when I was a boy, I didn't come from what they call a good Christian home. Homer did these kind of things to me on the phone. I had to call him down here, too. I didn't come from the type of home that would be considered a good Christian home. I come from a family of a bunch of screwballs. I had a working mother, and she overindulged me and spoiled me when she had a chance. And I had a father that was a professional bridegroom. And I also... And I had a notorious grandmother. I had this grandmother that weighed about 300 pounds, and she used to waddle out onto the street, and she'd blow her nose on her apron in front of my friends. And she'd feed me peanut butter and Cairo sandwiches. And I got real self-conscious about that and also got fat. And because I was fat and self-conscious, I was always thinking about myself. I discovered girls in third grade. And what are you going to do about that? I had a lot of trouble in grade school. About the time I was in... a lot of you guys know about that. Has nothing to do with alcoholism. About the time I was 8 or 9 years old, I acquired a stepfather. And used Jim Croce's phrase, he was as mean as a junkyard dog. And him and I didn't get along at all. And I was making bad grades in school, and I was uptight all the time and frustrated and angry and didn't want to be where I was at and couldn't afford to go where I wanted to go. And I got thrown out of a little ivy-covered high school, and they put me down at a place called Connolly Vocational High School, which was sort of like a stepping stone for reform school. And I got in trouble down there, and I had the wrong name to go into an all-boys school in the rough section of town, and I learned a lot about that. But I was always uptight, always lonely and frustrated, and I never fit in. All my early years, I started categorizing the people that were around me, my peers, my friends in school, as them. They were all them. It was me and them. Well, somewhere along the line, I don't know whether it was the day that I was forging my report card and the ink ran or whatever, but I took a drink. Now, if there's any non-alcoholics, there is non-alcoholics out here. When I took a drink, all that went away. The loneliness went away, the frustration, the anger, everything was fine. So I made a decision that I should drink, because drinking was good. It made things work for me, so I'd drink. Well, to show you how bright I was, I got married when I was 17 years old. To escape. So the little bride and I, you know, we settled down. I just imagined she had fantasies of white picket fences and all that jazz, you know. And I had thoughts about super nightclubs and having a lot of fun. And I developed a drinking pattern right away. I had a lot of drinking patterns. And my first drinking pattern that I remember, I fashioned myself as a gambler. But what I was a pinball machine freak. And to give you an example about what was happening in those days, on payday, I would rush down like a kid going to a show on Saturday. I was so excited. I'd get out there and I'd get down to this club I loafed at. I'd run over there and get $20 worth of nickels or whatever, and I'd get over there by the pinball machine. And I'd dump those broken rolls and dump the nickels on the machine. I'd get a few schooners of beer up there and a couple shots. I can't even see the machine. And I'd play the machine, and I'd be up to my, by the end of the night, I'm up to my ankles in nickel wrappers, and I'd maybe put my whole pay in the machine, and I hit for $5. Give everybody a drink. Then it'd be time to leave. You know, they'd put the chairs up on a bar, and they'd get one of those big brooms, and they'd sweep me and the cigarette butts out on the street. And then I'd stumble around out there looking for my automobile, you know, which if it was anywhere around near, you could spot it 10 miles away the way it was. You know, it was the kind of... I had the kind of car that everything, by the way, went wrong in my life, always, all the time. I had trouble with everything, always. And the car was no different. In the summertime, the windows wouldn't roll down. In the winter, they wouldn't roll up. Inspection was due tomorrow, and I always had a flat tire, and I always had a muffler hanging down, which would wake them neighbors up when I'd get up there and dragging that thing up the hill. And maybe I'd have somebody in the car. You know, that I'd forgot where I'm supposed to take them. You know, or maybe I'd forget they were there. Or maybe there'd be 14 tickets on my windshield. And then I could always blame the cop for breaking my windshield wiper, which was always broke anyhow. But I always used to drive my head out the window, because when you're real drunk, it's better that way, unless you're passing buses or something, you know.
I first started to serve up, I looked back and I just wondered if any of them hit me, you know. But it just seemed like, you know, that you have your problems when you're drinking, driving around like that. And in the summertime, I used to get bugs on my teeth. And I was always afraid to face that little woman of mine when I got home. You know, she weighed 115 pounds, you know, and I weighed about 250. About 25 pounds of it was hot sausage, another 25 Iron City beer, you know. And I'd stick my head out in the wintertime with all this anxiety and fear and guilt I had on the way home. And with all that going for you, you cry a lot, you know. And when you cry with your head out in the wintertime, your eyes freeze open. So then I'd get home. I'd drive up that hill, and I'd get home, and they seemed to be waiting for me. The neighbors, the lights had gone. You know, I never give it a thought that that muffler banging up and down and all that, and maybe me hitting a couple parked cars was waking them up. You know, I never thought of that. And I'd get up in front of the house, and if I wasn't real drunk, I might just get up on the curb. Now, if I was real drunk, I'd park on top of my neighbor's hedges, which sort of makes his hedges look like mine, because I always fell in mine, you know. There's a funny thing about that guy. He was real nice. I've always thought he was a nice guy. But what he was doing, he was cutting my hedges for me. He was trying to sell his house. Nobody would buy it the way mine looked next door. So he cut my hedges. But I'd get up front of the house and get the car finally stopped, you know, and the radiator hissing and everything banging in it, you know. And I'd get on that bum and I'd walk up onto the porch and then I'd try to look sober, you know, right? I'd get straightened out, you know. Maybe I'd even have the foresight to zip my pants back up. And I get up on that porch, you know, and I reach out and I grab a hold of the doorknob, and that doorknob was connected directly to my wife's mouth inside. We'd fight. We'd go out, we'd fight about all the money I spent gambling. And that went on for a good while. Just fight about the money I spent gambling. She didn't even know. She was so hurt about that money, not to be able to pay the rent and all, but she didn't even notice how drunk I was, you know. And I got away with that for a long time. But see, clearly the gambling started cutting into my drinking money somehow, and I quit it. I just quit doing it. I just started to drink. Just drink and don't gamble no more. And then she brightened up and seen there was more problems than just me gambling. And meanwhile, I'm having all these other problems. It's not like they weren't having any problems at work. They weren't having any problems here and there and trouble with their wives getting on their backs all the time. Just me. Just seemed like it was only me. And I'm having a few accidents here and there with my car. I'm just denting them to death. And the chrome's falling off and the headlights are broke, you know. And all my cars were like this. As a matter of fact, I had one car in particular I like to remember. It helps me keep me sober. I bought a family man's car back in 1964, I think it was. I bought a 61 Plymouth Fury convertible. Family man's car. And I paid $1,600 for it. It was a nice-looking car. And I had it a little over a year, and I traded it in, and I got $50 for it. See, I'd left the top down. It had rained in the car. It caught on fire right in front of the fire department. Where else? You know, they practiced with everything on it. They used foam on it and powder and water. Then I drank down at Fireman's Club, you know, and I had to go through that. It was like running a gauntlet going in there. Oh, here comes Dempsey, crazy Dempsey, though. How do you like your car since we powdered it for you, you know? And I'd say, they're going to get it sometime, them, you know. But I got into the area just drinking and going out, and I was a little bit of a drummer. I played drums in a small combo, and I loved that. I'd get out of the house, and the alcoholic needs a place where he can drink, a bag he can get into where he can do a lot of drinking and get away with it. And I was a drummer, you know. And I'd go out to these clubs, and I couldn't wait to get out there. And I noticed a lot of strange things about my drinking. For instance, like, I had a favorite drink. The only people I ate would understand it. Broma seltzer and whiskey. Anybody could figure that out. Well, my stomach started going on me. I'd go in a bar and I knew right away that the people thought it was funny to odd to drink broma seltzer and whiskey. And so I'd whisper to the bartender, you know, give me a broma seltzer and whiskey. He said, broma seltzer, and everybody turn around. I put them on my list as them. You know. So I'm starting to have trouble with this little woman at home. She's starting to nag me, and I'm starting to miss work, and I'm starting to be late for work, and I'm having trouble on my job. And I didn't know it until after I got into AA that I had been fired on five jobs for drinking. I didn't know that. I thought all of a sudden I got fired for the reason they told me. You're not working out good here, you know. I didn't think I was drinking. You know, I thought, you know, the only way you get fired for drinking is just fall down dead drunk right in the middle of the floor. Eyes drunk, farm, you know. No. They fired me for being incompetent or not being around. Jack, you've got to come around here once in a while. But I just couldn't get in. You know, you'd get nervous in bad traffic and everything. You got to stop and have a little drink. And a couple of drinks, you know, and what the hell? I'm a young man. I want to party a little bit. I'll make up for it later, you know. And I'd get drunk. And I'm having trouble with my wife. And by this time, my wife is starting to, like, teach me a lesson for drinking, you know. Like, for instance, if I got drunk and I was gone all night, I'd get home, you clean that cellar, you know. Yes, dear, hang my head and I'd go clean it. Now, if I drank like 2 days, gone all day and all night, I had to clean the cellar, paint a room. Look at that room, crummy, filthy. Nobody has a room like that. And look at the fingerprints on a wall. Well, you know, you got them arms out when you're stumbling down. Yeah. And heaven only knows where an alcoholic has had his hands, you know what I mean. So she'd be asking me all the time about that. Now, if I go on a good drunk, you know, I was always drinking. I wasn't a periodic. I was drinking all the time. But I'd really get going, like on payday, I got drunk. It was, you don't get drunk on payday, there's something wrong with you, you know. So I'd get drunk on payday, just completely blowed out of my shoes, you know. And I'd get on there and go home, and I'd be oblivious to the fighting and everything. I'd just be so drunk. And then Friday night, while everybody gets drunk, and I'd get drunk Friday again. That'd be two going for me. And Saturday morning when I come to, I'd start drinking right away. Get on the street and get a haircut. I used to have them 9-hour specials on a haircut. And so I'd get drunk all day and maybe come back home and hope she'd be down the cellar so I could sneak into her purse. And she could be down next block and she could hear that purse open up. Well, I'd go in there and I'd get anything out of her I could sell. She had stamps or anything in there, you know. Get a green stamp book and buy and get a blanket with it and hawk it in the bar, anything, you know. Just give me something tangible I can work with, you know. Then I'd get drunk a couple times on Saturday. I'd really get wasted on Saturday night, you know. And now you figure I've been drinking all week and I've been blowed clean out of my socks from Thursday through Saturday. And Sunday comes. And she's telling me, waking me up with ice water or whatever, and saying, all right there, honey boy, you're going to clean that cellar and you're going to paint a room. And for today, you're going to take the family to the zoo, you know. Now, I used to finally get up and get, like, mobile. I mean, I knew the body was going because I could see, like, a silhouette, you know. And she'd take me down there, get me down at the zoo. I'd drive, you know. We'd get down and we'd always be late, so we had to park way where nobody parks and walk 10 miles, it seemed, in a blazing sun and get up to that zoo. And she'd station me right in front of them stinking hippopotamuses. And I'd stand there belching, and I used to throw up a lot. But I got so that, you know, I wouldn't really throw up, I'd just go, Now, when I did that, people would always say, what's the matter with you? That's no time to carry on a conversation. And then, I used to get these kind of headaches. These were hangovers. Social drinkers call these hangovers, see? My head was hurting so bad with a headache that I couldn't turn it. When you talk to me, I turn my whole body. Yeah. And things were sore, you know? I'd have a lump here, a cut over here. I'd say, ooh. You know, what's... Oh, and I'd remember, you know, flash... That's when I fell over the urinal down at Carl's Bar and Grill, you know? And my one foot would seem shorter than the other. That's when I'd look and notice I had two different kind of socks on, you know. And my shirt would be buttoned funny, you know. And I was a mess, and I had a flannel shirt on, and it was July. And I need a shave, only on one side of my face. And I got the little bride next to me, you know. I'm a little bride, don't look all that great. She's been waiting up for me for 24 hours a day for 4 days. Her hair's all stringy and she's been wringing her hands. Her palms are sweating. She only weighs 90 pounds and 80 of its wedding rings, you know. And I got the little kid next to me, our daughter, who's completely fearful of the boat screwball she got for parents. She don't know whether her daddy's going to throw her mother into the hippopotamus. the way her mother will beat the daddy with a purse. Well, it's going to go on, and she's a nervous wreck. Now, right next to this mess that I got, or she has, whether you're an Al-Anon or AA. There comes a family of them. Pull right up beside me, see? And they usually have, the guy has a nice sport jacket on. A little gray in his temples. He looked like this guy that's sober 28 years that brought me down here, you know, to keep me honest. He was a neat, respectable, dignified-looking gentleman. And I hated him. And next to him was he had a beautiful little wife that clutched onto his arm and just look up into his eyes adoringly, you know? And they'd have a little boy there, a little girl there, or whatever, and they would scamper off, and he'd say, "Johnny," and turn around, "Yes, Daddy, come back, Johnny, yes, Dad," obediently come right beside his dad, you know? And they'd stand there and smile at that stinking animal. I got all these things going inside me. I'm wondering how I'm going to dodge this debt and how I'm going to explain to her I spent the mortgage, you know? And all this is reeling in my mind right beside that headache. They both fit, you know. And all these sores are hurting me and my stomach's burning up from the doctor told me not to drink, you know. And I was just so damn sick. And there's my wife all messed up and my little girl would take off and I'd say, "Dubby!" Ah, she'd scream. Mother would turn around with that crooked finger. See, like all them wives have crooked fingers, you know. And she'd say, "Don't you holler at that child after what you did last night." And I don't even know if he put St. in yet, see? But I knew they were coming, you know. Because they always came. They would always turn me in. If I would dare have mixed some fun with my alcoholism somewhere, I would get caught because I was a dumb alcoholic, you know. And so there we'd be, and I'd get the fight going. By this time, the humiliation was too great for me, and I'd start fighting with her, and she'd fight with me, and off down the car, I'd drag him down there and get him in that car, and maybe the final humiliation, I'd have a flat tire, or I was out of gas because I spent the $2 she doled out to me on wine, forgot to get gas, you know, you forget. But I'd get home, and I'd dump her off, and I'd get on the club. Down the club, the air conditioner was running, and the music was playing, and I got the hell out of there, and everything was all right again. But then it was 2:00 in the morning again. And I was getting swept out of the joint again and again to the tickets on my car. And to being late for work the next morning over and over and over. Until I had so much hate in me and just resentment and bitterness. And the fact that I couldn't handle none of this. It was too much for me. I was always getting drunk in front of some potbelly squire with a, you know how they look. Like I got a T-shirt on, looks like it was washed with a porch rug, you know? And they sit there and they got a 400-year-old pheasant on the wall, and they take $150 out of you for going through a red light or something. I knew what I needed. I needed a power greater than myself, and I finally found one. Beneficial Finance Company. I was introduced to Beneficial Finance Company with a confidential loan. Now, there's a little trick to that. If you don't pay that, it's no longer confidential. So then I had to go through the routine. I'm sure a lot of you have done it. The working style alcoholic that's trying to work in a mill or whatever and drink too. Of taking the little wife down there after you get about 150 jackballs all together in one unmanageable mess. And you take her down and get in that little office of Beneficial down there. And there's 150 little girls running around here, all pretty, you know. And she'll say, "Oh, Mr. Dempsey, take booth 4 and sit in there. And Mr. Farnsworth will be with you in about a year." You know. So you sit there and sweat and shake, worrying about whether you're going to get $800 or something to buy a car that you already wrecked. And you got your wife sitting in there, and you know how much she loves you. And she's sitting there with you for an hour, just thinking about borrowing $800. If I ever go through this again with you, you know. Well, she did things. She used to starch my shorts and everything else to get even with me. I have a lot of trouble with shorts. You know, I never once run into a social drinker that changed his shorts in a gas station. And I used to have to do that. That was awkward, you know. I used to be in filthy, dirty clothes and buy a new set of underwear, and friends of mine would say, what the hell are you buying new underwear for? Never mind. They ask the dumbest questions, okay? So I was always going through this punishment, her punishing me and me fighting with her. It sort of kept my attention on her rather than on the outside world, which probably kept me out of jail longer. And the chairman that I was mentioning about honest politicians, thank God for dishonest politicians, I'd still be locked up, you know. So I'm having trouble with my wife, with my car, with my... Everything is going wrong, and I'm losing my insurance, and they're just bearing down on me, and I'm up to my eyebrows in debt with Beneficial Finance Company and a half a dozen other ones, and I'm just a mess, and I don't know what to do about it. So I get drunk about it, and I kept getting drunk about it until bad things started to happen. It started to dawn on me that I wasn't having fun drinking anymore. You know, it wasn't just all that fun and games out there. And I was starting to just sit in the corner bar and the corner table with my head in my hands and my elbows on the table, you know, looking at a flat beer, wondering what's going to be next in this shining life of mine, you know, whether she's going to murder me in my sleep or what the hell's going to happen. Or I wonder how they'll fire me this time, you know. And I was sick of this, and I was looking for a way out, you know. And I had all of it. You know, down, when you get down the avenue, like I'd get down into the parts of Pittsburgh, I'm sure you have them in Cincinnati, you know, where you can get away with lining five shots up on a bar, you know, and it doesn't matter whether your nose falls on the end of the bar. You know, just if you fall over, it'll shove you in a corner. You know, and I'm drinking in these kind of places, and I'm just a wreck, and I knew there was something wrong with me. And I'm trying to get out of this thing some kind of way. I thought maybe I could read my way out of this thing. You know, I recall something I read. I read an article in Reader's Digest called Joe's Liver, you know. And it said something in there about if you drink so much during a certain length of time, why, you know, it'll do so much cellular damage. But if you space your drinks, if you know, there's a certain quota you can drink that it cells replace themselves, whatever. I drank a year's quota while I was reading the article. You know? And I got into some of the other kind of literature, self-improvement books, you know. I'm reading Norman Vincent Peale, and I'm reading, you know, Enthusiasm Makes a Difference, Psycho-Cybernetics, you know, How to Make $14 Million and Have Fun, you know, all that junk. And I'm finally graduating into a little bit of philosophy and a little bit of Eric Fromm, and the literature's getting heavier and I'm getting lighter. I heard a thing that described me perfectly one night, and this other guy was accused of it. I'm glad they didn't say it to me, because I'm very sensitive. I told this guy that he was educated beyond his intelligence, and that fit me real good. But I did manage to get enough of a self-education that I could get in these grand philosophical arguments with clergy, you know, who were top on my them list by this time. Because I was I was half-crazed with people who seemed to be making it, and they would just say, why don't you make it? You know, why just don't, you know, just quit drinking and being a big jackass and get happy like us. Go to our picnic this Sunday and sit around and watch them old ladies and everything like the other speaker talks about. And I just couldn't cut any of that stuff. You know, I couldn't cut it. I wanted the good part out of the fast life, you know. I wanted to be able to stop after work with the guys and have a gang of beers. You know, and I wanted the good sounds in the club and listen to the bands and dig out all the good stuff, but I didn't want to be puking on my front porch. I didn't want to get into these moments of violence where I thought maybe I might kill my wife. That I just might do like I've done one night. Got angry at a guy, I don't know what trivial thing he said to me, but I'm out there like Steve McQueen and Bullet chasing him around with my car. It's a good thing I was drunk and I hit him. He's running all over the parking lot. Oh, crazy, you know. I get him, you know. That's not social drinking. Dr. Silkworth talked about different kinds of alcoholics in the beginning of the big book, and one he mentions is me. It says there are those who are dangerously antisocial. See? I didn't want that to get out. See? Because I knew where I belonged. I belonged in some kind of a cage. But that was the worst place to put me, because I couldn't even stand in my living room. I'd tell my wife, I'm not going to drink today, and I'd walk up and down like a lion. I ain't drinking, look at me. You know, she'd say, for heaven's sakes, get the hell out of here and drink. Thank you. You know. Glad I got a reprieve. You know, I'd go out and I'd get drunk again. It was time after time, and the humiliation started to set into my life. I'd like to mention one of them in particular. By this time, my girl was 12 years old or whatever, and I had been just casually telling her lies, because that's the way I dealt with them, with anybody, because I felt like I was trying somehow to just get by in life, and these other people were hurting me and getting at me, and they were in my way, and I just dealt with them superficially. I'd say to anyone to hear to get my thing going, to get away from you, to get a drink. And one day I apparently told my daughter, she said, "Where are you going, Daddy?" And I don't even remember it, but I told her, "I'm going to the hardware," or whatever, you know. And I was going to get drunk. And so one of her little girlfriends next door questioned her on where her daddy was, and she said, "He's down the hardware store." And the little girl says, "No, he's not. His car's parked in front of the Moose down the street." And you know, it crushed my daughter. But I didn't know that till later. But I did know the time that I was taking on little extra jobs. I was a pipe fitter in the shop by this time, and I was putting kitchen sinks and whatever at night, moonlighting, and trying to make money to support my habit. One night, I got paid to do a job, and the guy gave me $15 for material. And I went out, and I got drunk. I didn't buy the material. So naturally, I had a fight with my wife that night because I was late getting home. But I told her the next day, I said, "I got to go do that job. I promised the guy." So she allowed me out, you know, how they do. But she sent my daughter with me, you know how they do. And I took my daughter with me, and I got down to that place, and that guy said, "Well, I thought you were going to finish that job last night. You didn't come back." And I said, "Well, no." I said, "Another thing is, you know, I tried to con him a little bit. I said, I don't have quite enough money to get the material." Well, he knew better. He said to me, "Look, I give you $15 to buy the material." I said, "No, I need more." He said, "Don't lie to me." He's like, "I give you $15. And meanwhile, my little girl, Stan, my 12-year-old, she's standing there looking back and forth at us. And he said, "Look, I don't want you to do the job." I said, "Well, I don't have the $15 to give you back." He said, "I don't want you." He says, "You keep that $15. So you're nothing but a drunken bum. I don't need you on this job." Right in front of my little girl. And I walked out that house, and I felt that rage. I wanted to smash that guy for doing that, but I knew damn well, deep down inside, it wasn't his fault. I knew it was me. I knew that I was a drunken bum because I took that lousy, stinking $15 and blew it because I had to have a drink. I had to. See? And my little girl would have that terrified look in her eyes, and I didn't even understand it then. I had to get sober at AA before I could understand. But she was afraid of her daddy's reaction. She knew her daddy had been humiliated again. And she's seen me humiliated before when I broke up the living room furniture, when I punched holes in the wall. There's a funny thing about punching holes in the wall. You know, after I got sober, I had a piece of wallboard to put up, and I must have drove 150 nails. I couldn't find that stub, but one night when I was drinking, first swing, I'd smack that stub. A lot of bad things happened when I was drinking. It just didn't happen to the guys in the movies, you know? Like one night to show my wife how mean I was, I threw a radio, and it was plugged in, almost tore my fingernail off, you know? Then it fell on my foot. She stood there and laughed. I remember one night I come home drunk, and I was in the bathroom. We lived in a little house near the tracks, naturally. That's a good place for alcoholics. Get down there where the tracks, where the all night bars are, whatever. And that's where I live. And I was down there, and I came in real drunk and late, and I went in there to throw up. And while I was down on my knees, I thought I might as well stay here and sleep. But I did manage to get everything off of my shorts. Now, we lived in this little dumpy place, and we had a gas razor in there. I don't know whether I was having hallucinations or a good dream or whatever, but just felt the warmth of that woman next to me, you know? And I threw the bare leg up on top of that gas razor. Well, I got sober quick, though. And I run out in the kitchen screaming for the little woman. And she come out, she's biting her lip to keep from laughing, you know? And a big red welts on my legs, and boy, I was moaning about lousy gas resonators, and how comes my house got to be like a dump? Oh, those people I went to school with, my peers, them, and Smilets, they're all moving out in the suburbs in a nice little ranch-type home out there, having beautiful little lawn parties, of which I don't get invited, and doing fine. And me, I'm living in a dump like this. And my wife had just kept her mouth shut when I said things like that. Well, eventually, I had got myself into a situation where I couldn't read my way out of this. I had visited the clergy. I'm one of the kind of guys that when a Salvation Army would give you those pamphlets on the street down in the batter sections of town, I would read them, you know. I wouldn't read them. It seemed like everybody that threw them away was doing fine. I don't want that garbage. Gotta get out and pick up my Cadillac now.
You know.
Not me. I'm reading it. Well, I can't only have nothing. I'm going on a bus.
You know.
I just got to smash my car. I had a guy from the finance company coming down to collect payments on a car that was wrecked in the driveway. I said, look what I got there.
He said, just give me the payment. You know. That's your problem. You wrecked the car. Don't you have insurance? I said, that's another thing. You know. I was mad because I couldn't get insurance. You know, it goes up every time you have a wreck.
So I'm starting to carry their mail for them. I'm paying wrecks out of my own pocket, and I'm letting the insurance company slide. Say, that's a hell of a way to do business. I'm paying them to insure me, and I'm paying for my own accidents. But I knew I'm saving it for the biggie. You know, one of these days, I'm going to wipe out a bus or something. You know. And my wife say, when are you going to go? You know, and I'm going, don't worry, what's wrong? You know, and I was putting on a lot of weight, and I said, one of these days, I'm going to explode. And she believed that. You know. So she had no trouble getting an alibi, you know. So anyhow, she started leaving me. You know, they'll leave you, they'll let you down when you're hurting. And she left me, and, well, first she was up just hiding from people. She'd go up and just close the blinds, and she didn't want to explain about this jerk anymore. You just couldn't answer where. Somebody said, where is he? Huh. You know, where is he? I don't know. Maybe he's out in Cincinnati. You know, he might be down here. I might have forgotten. Just come down here. And got drunk and went back home. Said, boy, have a good time in Cincinnati. What do you do? I got drunk. Is what I did. That's all I ever did. I used to sit and wonder in a bar, who would have to find $1 million? $1 million would move me 3 feet up that shelf. Instead of getting drunk here, get drunk there. Same thing. No difference. So she's leaving me, and I ended up, I have to go see the head shrinker, you know, and I'm down there arguing with him, because already, you know, I've read the head shrinks. Eric Fromm's my specialty, man. I can argue with the clergy. I can surely argue with the psychiatrist, too, and I did. You know, and he got out of there, I was nuts, I guess. And I left. You know, I know a lot of people think that, for them, I imagine it's very important to say that they weren't honest with the psychiatrist. Well, I was honest with the psychiatrist, and the only conclusion he drew that I was nuts. He's nuts, drinks too much, he's nuts. So, I left. And, I mean, she left me. Well, as a matter of fact, she was gone 3 days, and I didn't even know it. That's the condition I was in. But once I knew it, I got geared up to feel real bad. You know, and you know how alcoholism is. She left around Christmas, you know, and me sitting under an empty Christmas tree crying, you know, and just, my whole world was coming apart. I was a mess. And I deserved a lot of the trouble I was in, you know. And I had a lot of garbage I had to take care of and a lot of things wrong with me. And, but finally what happened was, as a result of all this chaos and everything, to break it down, I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a neighbor that used to chase his wife down the street with a butcher knife and all that. You know, I knew he was an alcoholic. And he got sober and quit that. And so when I got in all these jackpots and I had everything going, I went to him. And I said, you got to help me. And he took me to an AA meeting. And when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to recover. Recover from alcoholism. I didn't have no idea what alcoholism was then. And I know what it is for me now. I know what I am when I say I'm an alcoholic. I know the problems that I have. I'm starting to separate now the difference between living problems and alcoholism problems. I've done everything to know what alcoholism was then. And I know what it is for me now. I know what I am when I say I'm an alcoholic. I know the problems that I have. I'm starting to separate now the difference between living problems and alcoholism problems. I've done everything wrong when I was first in AA, and I think everybody needs to do that. The best lessons I learned in AA so far have been doing the wrong thing and not drinking anyhow, you know. I learned from that good. You could tell me, you know, I was in the beginning of my AA, I was going to this one particular discussion meeting every Sunday night. I come back from there as tight as a banjo string, you know. And I told my family, I got enough. I blew up in front of one of my sponsors. They got doing good. You know, he said, how you doing? Fine. You know, he said, how you doing? And I said, I'll tell you something. That Sunday night meeting is rotten. I hate it. And he said to me, what is that? That discussion meeting down. I said, yeah. He said, don't go there anymore. I never saw a thought of that. Don't go there. I couldn't get that together. Now I'm going to AA and I'm complaining about my wife, that stinking rotten woman, she's this, she's that, you know, and the guys that listen to me.
Somebody said to me, well, man, why don't you leave her? That's heavy. Leave my wife. Oh. They said, well, let's shut up about her. I don't want just like her. So eventually, through the good grace of God, this program, my wife, I like to think that I did it. I like to think I drove her into Al-Anon. I was doing goofy things like washing the dishes. She'd holler at me, I'd wash the dishes. I'll show her, take the garbage out. She's thinking I'm neurotic, you know. And I was. I was nuts. I'd get mad at her, I'd get in an audible of her, and I'd get out of the cellar and stand in the middle of the cellar for 45 minutes. Just stand there. See it signs in AA that says, think. My sponsor says, Nancy, don't think. I know what to do. So as a result, it just overwhelmed me some point in my beginning there that I was absolutely powerless over all this madness. You know? Just, I can't handle it. I can't handle it. And people were saying, God bless you. Am I glad if Dempsey finally got the I can't handle it part? You know? A spiritual awakening, brother. A spiritual awakening. The guys were telling me, Dempsey, don't you think you ought to clean up your act a little bit? You know? I mean, I heard a story in AA that I'll share you. I'll steal when I tell you. A guy was new in the program. I don't know whether it's true or not, but it sure fits. This guy was new in the program, and he got on a Pullman train, and somehow the tickets had been messed up, and he pulled the curtains back on his berth, and there was two girls in there. Two young, beautiful girls. And he stammered and spit and said, I'm in the AA, and I've been sober for 6 months. One of the girls says, what are you trying to say? He said, well, what I'm trying to say is one of you girls will have to leave. So it dawned on me somewhere along the line, and I started cleaning up my act, and I took a fourth and fifth step, and I started to come in Alcoholics Anonymous and belong. I walked in there and way down deep inside my guts, I said to myself, Jack Dempsey, you belong to Alcoholics Anonymous. By damn, you belong. I was comfortable around the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was grateful for it. And I just turned that gratefulness around, and it's love. I love it. I love the people in AA. I love the fact that I'm sober, and I love the fact that I can tell somebody I'm sober, and they're glad for me. Because you can on the street tell the others, but they have been sober for a while. You know, so what? So why? You know? It's a big deal for guys like you and I to get sober. See? And I'm sober. And I respect members of Alcoholics Anonymous who are sober. I respect them. And after I cleaned up my act somewhat, I could feel the respect, you see. Now, as soon as I got sobered up and just day by day, pills were coming home instead of getting thrown away. And eventually, I had this dump of a house with refrigerators on the porch, you know, a dump with wall-to-wall water bugs in it. And I said to my wife, we got to get out of here. Look at this crummy place. She's, I've been telling you for 15 years what a dump. I said, well, I'm getting out of here. We moved. So I bought me a house out there in the suburbs. Now I got a lawn to cut, is what I got. See? I'm cutting the grass, but at least I ain't smoking it, you know? So good things in a material way were starting to come my, you know, just naturally come my way, you know. The guy told me, first thing a guy gets sober, he gets his teeth fixed and buys a tape recorder. That's all he does, you know. Buy a new suit, you know. All that things happen. And I chased around at 12-step calls, and I didn't know what else to do, you know, get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and run all over the place and bring people into your house and have your wife sit around with 4 or 5 friends of yours, and half of them are still drinking, the other half are going to commit suicide tomorrow. And, you know, go through all that and go through wanting to really earnestly sober them up for their own sakes. And little by little, just doing it, actually doing it, is what beats you into knowing, I think, or beats me into knowing what this program is for. This program is for me. I'm doing these things for me. And if I'm good, good. That's good for me. I'm glad you think I'm good. My mother-in-law thinks I'm the best thing since sliced bread. You know?
And I attribute to the fact that I'm not throwing up on her anymore, you know? All the variables are good. But finally, through the steps in this program, through actually doing the inventory steps and making amends, actually making them. I made amends to that step while I hate it. No, I love them. I don't like them, but I love them. And, you know, I made amends to him, and he didn't know what the hell I was talking about. You know, we went out there recently, and I guess he was testing my humility or something. He said, go get me a beer, boy. I went in, I got him a beer. I shook it up before I had it, so, boy. He pulled the top off the beer and went all over the place. He's pretty smart. He's a sharp alcoholic, you know. I'd say he's an alcoholic who acts like one. He said, well, you shook that beer up, didn't you? I said, no, it just makes me nervous when I'm holding a beer. So we got back. I was out of Chicago. We got back, and I didn't get no trouble, and everything was all right. My whole group laughed at me. Oh, out of Chicago. How are you doing out there? You know. Well, I was out there just living, just taking my family out there, just trying to get by and trying to work their way and use their way to keep my own sanity. They're still alive. Now, I have this daughter I told you about. She got married, made a grandfather of me. I love her. And I love my son-in-law. I couldn't marry her. You know, it's just like as if to teach me something. My daughter married a drummer. You imagine that? And he's better than me, too. I don't like that. But I don't care, you know. I'm glad about that. But that girl had, when I first got these material things coming and I started working a program, I bought myself my first new car. First car I ever had, it was new. And I was busy feeling good about that and just feeling clean and good because life was starting to... I was starting to earn my keep and I was damn proud of it. And I had my little girl in the car with me and we were going somewhere. And she said to me, how do you like your car, Dad? And I says, I like it fine. And she says, well, you deserve it. And by God, that hit me like a ton of bricks. Mostly because she said it, but secondly because I was able to feel it. I was able to feel right down in my guts that my little girl loved me, actually loved me, you know. And when I go home, sometimes my wife loves me, you know. I went through a period where I thought my wife took the regular Al-Anon chastity vows, you know. My wife got over that. But if any of you girls out there don't know it, I'd like to tell you that sex is not a character defect. So AA's been good to me, and Al-Anon's been good to me. And I want to save you some time to enjoy each other tonight, and I'd like to thank everyone on the committee for being so good to me and for treating me like a human being, which AA made me. And God bless every one of you.
Wow, how's that for openers? Any indication of how this conference is going to go for the next couple of days, we're in for a lot of fun and a lot of good AA. And you know, I told you I was jerky when I got up here, and I asked Jack before the meeting, I said, do you want to open the meeting with a Saturday prayer? He said, no, you go ahead. And that's the reason I go to meetings every night, because I forget. When I was playing ball, you know, when you get it before the game, they put tape on your wrist, they'd mark certain plays down for you, so when you got in a situation, third and four, you could... If you didn't have it up here, you had it on the tape on your wrist, and you could see what play it was appropriate to call that time. Well, I wear short sleeve shirts now, but I guess I'm going to have to go back to the tape and do what my wife always says. Now, don't forget to open the meeting with a Serenity Prayer. So I feel more comfortable if you would, those who wish, would join me in the Serenity Prayer, please. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you.